With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown.
Margaret Thatcher. Life after Downing Street. The story of Margaret Thatcher's post-premiership years is a tale of high drama and low farce, with at its heart one extraordinary woman. It is a new and fascinating biography by Peter Just. I'm delighted to say that Peter joins me live on the line now. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Giles. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Most of us will sort of remember that Where They Were, and I've come across the iconic shot of Margaret Thatcher, Lady Thatcher in tears as she left Downing Street in the back of her car, of course, all those years ago. And perhaps we tend to sort of draw the line after that and just move on. But as your new biography shows, there was a rich and varied, to put it mildly, career that waited afterwards. Just tell me a little bit about why you decided to write this.
Well, I've always been fascinated about what former prime ministers do, i.e. what a prime minister does when they have resigned. We've had 50 of them in UK history, and actually remarkably little has been written about them in general. A couple of things I wrote, a book by somebody called Kevin Theakston, and more recently a short article by two academics called Alia Middleton and Louise Thompson. So the general point about what prime ministers do after they resign, I think, is just totally fascinating, because one day you have power and the next you don't. As for Margaret Thatcher, of course, I'm a child of the 1970s, so she played a huge, huge role in my life, being of that generation. And I was totally fascinated about how this person, perhaps above all, would cope with the new life that she needed to create. And actually, the more I've been researching it since the 28th of November 1990, effectively, from that moment she got in the car that you've talked about. And essentially, I think it's been under-researched. I think it's been shrouded in myth. And I think its long-term impact has been completely unappreciated. So those are my key messages, I think, to you on it.
Because the thing is, she was such a seminal figure in UK political life. I mean, you know, I'm a child of the 60s. And so therefore, you know, I would be 11 when she swept into power in 79. And, you know, the whole teenage thing, she was a figure that completely turned the UK on its head, for better or worse. You know, I grew up in that whole sort of loads of money environment. And when somebody like that leaves the political stage, you know, it's not a case of, right, I'm going to go off and do, especially somebody like her, it's not a case of, I'm going to go off and do some gardening leave and perhaps write a book about, you know, the British, the small birds of Britain, is it? I mean, there's a huge gaping hole, especially if you have been front and centre of world politics for such a time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And clearly for her, the actual loss of office and the circumstances of it were totally traumatic. But actually from about 1990 onwards, when she started to employ Sir Julian Seymour, and then 1992 Sir Mike Worthington, actually she did create for herself a completely new life. And we in the UK only saw one part of it, which is the life that she had in the UK and a lot of the trouble that she caused for John Major, William Hague and others. Actually, she had a huge role all around the world. She was in constant demand to visit countries and to give speeches about her life and her work. But also actually what she did do, which is what my research has found, which we didn't really know much about because the files in the National Archives have been released only since she died. She did loads and loads of work promoting Britain's foreign policy interests in the countries that she visited. And so she would also promote some British commercial companies. So she had an entire life all around the world that we've really not properly understood, I think, in the UK because of the way she was in this country.
You said she was going around, you know, talking, doing, obviously delivering her brand of politics. And people go, oh, Thatcherism, basically, that she destroyed the unions, you know, you buy your own council house, that sort of thing. But I was just watching something over the weekend, over like 100 days that changed the world. It was talking about the, you know, the coming down of the Berlin Wall, the Velvet Revolution, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, yeah, the Velvet Revolution before, and Romania. And then that follows, you know, and that is followed by the, you know, the implosion of the Soviet Union. Her and Reagan's Atlantic policies had therefore been justified, and the Soviet Union was no longer at that point something to be feared, because it wasn't going to last very much longer. And it was almost, this was the triumph of her foreign policy. Could you argue, Peter?
I think that is exactly what she would say to you if she were alive today, that of course she was a total and complete success. On a more serious point about the Soviet Union and about Eastern and Central Europe, after 1990, she played a hugely massive role there. Some of it was symbolic. So what she represented, exactly the things that you've talked about, she was a physical representation of the defeat of communism. And so that gave her huge amounts of symbolic importance, and she was revered in some of those Eastern and Central European countries. As for the Soviet Union, actually, she after 1990, the Margaret Thatcher Foundation talks about a quasi-state visit she paid in 1991. She continued to be really supportive of Gorbachev. She continued to be supportive of ensuring that the four reforms that he introduced while she was prime minister continued and were expanded in her time after being prime minister. And for the rest of her active life up to 2002, she took a huge, huge interest in Russia and its development. So, I think you're right in your analysis. She would clearly say you're right in your analysis. But what she also had after 1990 was this ongoing symbolic role, but actually also in those countries, a practical role. So if you look in the National Archives, privatization is all over the National Archives after 1990. So that practical policy she introduced in this country was effectively exported all around the world. And you see that playing out after 1990 as well.
As well as that, I just want to look at the international scene as well. What was the relationship? Did she, because again, I'm thinking of the 80s again. There was no stronger relationship, you could argue, than the relationship with Reagan, in terms of Britain being very much in a way that is, you know, perhaps Starmer is trying to do with President Trump at the moment. But, you know, those two, Thatcher and Reagan, it was perhaps the strongest period of the special relationship since the Iron Curtain came down. What was her relationship with like Reagan when they were both no longer at the helms of their respective countries?
Well, she continues to have a really sort of close personal relationship with him. Clearly, in addition to their personal relationships, as you pointed out, they represented something, didn't they? They are both a person, but they are also, well, they're both individuals, but they are also both an idea about how you run a country and how you think the world should be. So she continued to meet him. She would attend his birthday parties. Really memorably, in 1991, she went to one and she was a superstar there. She got two standing ovations during her speech. But beyond him, of course, she continued to try and influence the American government on issues of importance to her, one of which was Bosnia. But again, that's the practical stuff, isn't it? But she also had two other roles, really, one of which was she went around the world extolling American leadership and saying, actually, it would be a real disaster for the world and particularly for Europe if America disengaged. That's one thing. And then actually, as she became older and gradually more unwell, she again became a symbolic figure in America, particularly amongst Republicans. And actually in the book, I talk about some of this where various presidential candidates sought to invoke her or actually get her blessing for their candidature. So she had this practical role and also a symbolic one, which she never really did.
It's interesting you said the symbolic one, because they become a caricature, don't they? Or almost of the intricacies, the various nuances of the policies. And so she becomes this embodiment of Britannia, perhaps for the idea of for some Americans. You know, it is absolutely the iron lady, the lady's not for turning, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that. That's clearly something that she herself contributed absolutely massively to. So for all of the substance that you and I have talked about, because she was a woman of pure substance, there was actually also quite a lot of show business. So she went round the world basically playing up to and acting out that role of Iron Lady. She would invariably talk about her handbag as this huge symbolic thing. So absolutely, she was both an idea after 1990 and an individual.
So that's kind of a little bit of the international. But for the domestic, for the Conservative Party, who had turned, who, you know, who had been, it was almost Goya-esque, wasn't it, eating their own children. She was formidable, and it rankled. And she was, you know, she, I mean, there must have been successive Conservative Party leaders and prime and major, etc. must have looked, you know, must have shook or rolled their eyes or whatever else when they knew that, you know, that Lady Thatcher was about to make like almost an Olympic pronouncement from on high.
Absolutely. There is no denying the fact, particularly for John Major, who, you know, with respect for both him and for Margaret Thatcher, the pair of them were in a totally impossible position. She was a total superstar, wasn't she? She had such a seismic effect on our country that actually anybody who followed her would have found it difficult. Absolutely, when she spoke, very often it caused difficulties for the government under John Major, and then subsequently for William Hague when he was Conservative leader. But actually, again, even for all the difficulties she caused her successors, she was also nuanced and subtle. And there were things that she did that were helpful. I've mentioned... her promotion of British interests abroad. That's crucially important. But actually, there were various issues where she didn't speak out on, or she didn't actually express her mind fully on things. And there's some really wonderful stuff in the book about all the attempts that were made to try and stop her speaking. And she protested, you can imagine, she protested these attempts to keep her mouth shut very publicly. But essentially, for all of the leaders of the Conservative Party, and frankly, all of the prime ministers of whatever party since her, she has been a measure, hasn't she, against which they themselves are measured, sometimes by themselves, and it's virtually impossible to live up to what we think she was as a prime minister.
I remember remarks she made about Tony Blair when asked when he was in government, and she famously said, this is a withering put then, and I remember this even now, she said, history will not judge him well about Tony Blair.
Absolutely. But again, I have to say to you, if you go away and look at the National Archives, absolutely, because there's always that show business side of politics, isn't there? But behind the scenes, the story is more subtle and the story is more nuanced. So I talk about in the book, she was really, really helpful to him on Kosovo in 1999. So she spoke to him about it. She wrote to him. She met him. And at his request, she contacted the leader of the opposition in the Czech Republic, who was being a bit difficult on this issue, so she tried to put pressure on him. And she wrote a really strongly worded letter to Viktor Orban in Hungary, because Hungary wasn't playing ball in the way that we wished them to. And this letter goes up to Tony Blair from a civil servant. And seemingly in Tony Blair's own hand, he writes across this letter from April 1999 from Margaret Thatcher to Viktor Orban. Wonderful. So what we can see, Giles, is definitely one thing. The things we cannot see until about 20, 30 years until after they happen are actually really nuanced and subtle and interesting, clearly.
Talking about that thing with a view to Europe, because although she may have gone to the Soviet Union and she studied, she embodied those things about, I said her policies were right with the breakup of the Soviet Union. When it came to Europe, she was very, very nervous about a reunited Germany, wasn't she? She didn't want to see Germany become the dominant, as it did, you know, her idea of Germany reunification. It did concern her. Did she see what happened? It was happening in Germany through the 90s as perhaps again a justification of her fears of her policies.
Yeah, I think Germany was one of her foremost preoccupations throughout her entire life, and actually, when you look at her speeches and when you look at the things that are reported in the National Archives that weren't necessarily always said publicly, she had very, very strong views about Germany after 1990. And she was, you know, very concerned about its power, which is one of the reasons she was concerned about the Maastricht Treaty. I mean, ironically, even when Germany agreed with some of the things that she was saying on Bosnia and on Croatia, she still took a line that was effectively anti-German, because she just did have a thing about Germany, and also she had a thing about France, didn't she? So this continued long after she was prime minister.
Do you? I mean, does the book look at the personal life? Because obviously, Dennis was if you like her anchor during this time, and then he's not. You know, then there comes a period he's not there, and you talk about her health issues as well. I mean, are there, as we get towards the end of, before her illness strikes, are there signs of the deterioration that's to come?
I think it's really interesting about the book covers her private life, her public life and her political life, but it focuses mainly on her political life, because if she were here, that's what she'd have told me to do, because that's what she was interested in, politics for her entire life.
Yeah.
In terms of her personal life and her health, I talk about this briefly in the book. I think it is disputed about when her illness started. But even there, even when she became ill and she effectively retired from active political life in 2002, I would argue that even that period of her life from 2002 to 2013 was triumphant, because actually people, I think their views of her started to change. When you look at some of the press coverage when she was ill or she was in hospital and came home, it tended to play up to that Iron Lady image. Actually, I talk about the iconography of illness. So I think her reputation, ironically, when she stopped talking in 2002, I think that was one of the times that her reputation started to change for the better, because she was no longer effectively irritating us by telling us what to do. And we just looked at her. So actually, she continued to make public appearances. On all of those public appearances and the way that the press wrote about them played up to her image as the Iron Lady. So I think even that period of illness from 2002 on should be looked at in a way that is more positive than it has been today. But clearly for her personally, the loss of Sir Dennis was an absolutely huge and devastating blow, because he was so central to her life, and quite rightly she acknowledged she couldn't have done all the things she did without him.
When you look at it as well, I'm just thinking about... I'm just thinking about sort of former prime ministers having had an impact. You can argue that Blair has an impact. He's still active in the international stage. And I'm thinking the only other British prime minister I can think about is perhaps Churchill, because all the rest of them seem to fade into... I mean, you don't hear of... Wilson was ill towards the end of his premiership. Yes. Anyway. You know, Callaghan, you know, goes from the world stage. Gordon Brown doesn't really make an impact, but you can argue that only Blair, Thatcher, and perhaps to a certain extent Churchill, but because if he figures from the Second World War are still seen as Armand's Greases of the Armand-Gree of the political stage, even though they are no longer officially on it.
I would challenge your last point, because I think they are always on. I think they are always on the political stage by virtue of having been a prime minister. So the way that they use their stage and how often they appear on it is the thing that is different, but they are all still political figures. I think the ones who are still alive, it is quite difficult. Well, that's not true to say, forgive me. The ones who are currently alive, it is difficult to judge their impact currently, because we don't know what's happening behind the scenes. With Tony Blair, we'll start to get an idea quite soon when the National Archives start to release files from his time as being a former prime minister. I think on James Callaghan, if I may.
Yep.
Of all the former prime ministers in the end of the Second World War, he was hugely active in Parliament. In fact, of all of the 50 of them since 1742, nobody has intervened in Parliament as an ex-prime minister more than him, almost 500 times. By comparison, Margaret Thatcher, only 15. In terms of the practical difference that a former prime minister can make to people's lives, I think it would be fair to say that James Callaghan was the one who had the biggest impact, because in 1987, he persuaded the government to accept an amendment to a copyright bill that was going through Parliament that has enabled Great Ormond Street to, in perpetuity, have the royalties to Peter Pan. So that is a really practical difference to people's lives in this country that James Callaghan made.
I stand corrected. I stand corrected. No, absolutely not. So there you go. So you just completely reappraised my views on James Callaghan. I love doing the show, I tell you. You've mentioned the National Archives quite a few times. So this to get to the hub of this book, the nub of this book, you presumably spent a lot of time in Kew. I mean, how did you actually come to actually compile the information for Margaret Thatcher, Life After Downing Street?
Well, back in the 1990s, I was doing a PhD in what prime ministers after they resigned. So I collected a lot of material and I interviewed a lot of people. So I already had quite a lot of material. And then I was asked to do a presentation at a conference in the House of Lords in September 2023. And I was told you only need to write 10,000 words. And the first draft was 80,000, which, of course, I think tells you quite a lot about Margaret Thatcher and quite a lot about our reaction to her. So I'd already had a lot of material. Then I went to look at the National Archives, and actually the stuff there is just totally, totally fascinating. So I spent many, many happy hours there. And what that has done it has added a different dimension to how we look at their lives, particularly hers, after she was no longer prime minister. Because what we tend to see are the things that people say, the things that are reported in the press, and the things that are in people's biographies. What we don't always see is the stuff that is happening behind the scenes. And that is the stuff that actually displays a whole different light on her role as a former prime minister. And actually really does, I think, demands that we adjust how we've seen her life after Downing Street.
And she still stands head and shoulders, doesn't she? She still has an impact on Europe, on the situation with Putin. I mean, I think we pretty much know what her reaction to Putin's invasion of Ukraine would have been. You know, and in a world where the Conservative Party got itself into a right royal mess, and that's a technical term, Peter, as you'll understand, it got itself into a right royal mess. I almost said something else then. But, you know, her no-nonsense, if you like, stance, at least in, you know, on major issues, people are sort of harking back to it. I mean, I know that people always look back with rose-coloured binoculars to the past, you know, because the 80s, you know, we were around in the 80s. It wasn't all sort of mobile phones and red braces. There was Green and Common. There was, you know, massive implements. The miners' strike, if you came from north of, you know, I'm from Stoke-on-Trent, for goodness sake, it wasn't exactly loads of money up there. So, you know, it is very easy to go, it was a halcyon time, but still her impact. And she is still being mentioned when it comes to Europe and to and to world events. And you cannot dismiss that out of hand, can you, Peter?
No, absolutely not. In terms of Putin, just give my book a plug. I talk about Putin in there because she had things to say about him. So Palladius Putin. And actually, what I should say to you straight away, I should have said it at the beginning, forgive me. Spain features as well, because there's a really wonderful photograph of when she comes to Spain in 1992 and she meets King Juan Carlos and he kisses her hand and it's all very wonderful. Anyway, you are entirely right. I think there are two stories. There's two parts of Margaret Thatcher's life after Downing Street, one of which is her, undoubtedly her. But actually, the other part of it is us. Why are we still banging on about her now? 35 years after she left Downing Street, over 10 years after she died, and 100 years after she was born. What is it about her that causes us to bang on about her? So that's the first thing. In terms of her, as you've pointed out about how she's still so alive, effectively politically now, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think she would claim, justifiably, actually, she was completely competent in her role. So she was a competent person. Whether you agreed with her or not, she was competent. She almost demanded that people respected her just because of her competence. She knew what she wanted to do and she had the skills to do it. And she also had the skills not to do things when she knew that they would give her a lot of trouble. So there's always, isn't there, in the press coverage, even now about her and about prime ministers after her, when they do a U-turn. She was actually very skilled at avoiding U-turns because she was skilled enough to realise she shouldn't do something because it would cause a difficulty and she might have to go back on it. But again, even she did a U-turn, didn't she? Was it on the 21st of November 1990? She said, "I fight on, I fight to win." Mm-hmm. And the next day she resigned.
Yeah. Does the book look at the Pinochet affair at all? Is that covered?
That is one of the four main areas in terms of policy that it looks at. So it looks at the European Union. It looks at the former Yugoslavia. It looks at Hong Kong and China. And clearly it looks at General Pinochet. And in fact, that's the other part where Spain is mentioned. But I better, with respect to you, the country you are in, not say much more than that. But yes.
It was a really interesting period because you have that whole... Because obviously Chile at the time were very supportive of Britain against Argentina. They provided some vital information as well, and that was a very, should we say, that was a very testing period for her political skills and her loyalties as well.
Right. She had a very clear view about General Pinochet. That was whatever had happened in Chile, he had been extremely useful and helpful to this country during the Falklands War. And that his arrest in this country was completely wrong. And she talks about that at length in her book, Statecraft. Mm. Actually, in relation to the Spanish aspects of that, she did write to the Spanish Prime Minister about it. She wrote to who was then Pope John Paul II about it, asking him to make a personal and political public intervention. And she also wrote to Tony Blair. So again, everything that she was doing publicly, there was stuff behind the scenes. And then very famously, when General Pinochet was released, as his plane is on the tarmac about to take him back to Chile, she sends him a silver Armada dish. with a note saying that I'm sending you this for the last time we had a great victory over the Spanish. And this caused huge angst in Spain. And apparently the Spanish foreign minister was apoplectic, to which I responded, I clearly made my point. So, yeah, that is, you know, that is just so hair, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Peter, what are you hoping before I get shut down by a Spanish government official? What are you hoping that people will take from this fascinating book?
Well, I think two things, one of which is I hope people start to understand better than we currently do the importance of studying the lives of former prime ministers. We've currently got 8 of them, more than we've ever had alive at any one time. So actually, the office that she held as a former prime minister needs better understanding. That's the first thing. Secondly, I hope it is the start of a process in which we reassess and reappraise Margaret Thatcher's life after Downing Street so we better understand what it was, what she achieved, what she failed to achieve, and the impact that she actually had, because it's always been, currently up to now, seen in a very negative light. So I want to try and redress the balance.
The book is called Margaret Thatcher, Life After Downing Street. It is by Peter Just. Listeners, if you go onto the TRE virtual bookstore, you will see a photograph of the front cover. Click on that and a well-known delivery service will be winging its way to you. Peter, if people want to follow you online and say nice things to you, where's the best place to find you?
Or even bad things, because I'll take them on in the usual style, as you can imagine, of the person I've studied. I'm what used to be called Twitter. I'm ex-premiers. I'm similarly on Blue Sky, and I am similarly on Instagram.
Wonderful. The book is called Margaret Thatcher, Life After Downing Street. It's by Peter Just. Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
No worries, Giles. Thanks so much.